At Midway USA, we know the AR-15 is one of the most popular rifles in modern American history. Known for its modularity and widespread use, it's often considered essential to any gun collection. The essential things you need to run an AR-15 are usually always in stock during shortages, things like magazines and 5.56 ammo. Whether you're looking to buy a new AR-15 or buy parts for your modern sporting rifle, log on and for just about everything for the outdoors, shop MidwayUSA.com. Hunting boots are a critical component of any successful hunt. Whether walking a short distance to your blind or trudging miles through rugged terrain, your feet are carrying the load. Without the right boots, you could give up early and lose out on that trophy just over the ridge. At Midway USA, we make selecting boots for your next hunt easier. With just a few clicks of a mouse, you can decide on what's important, like waterproofing, insulation, size, width, and savings. For just about everything for shooting, hunting, and the outdoors, check out MidwayUSA.com.
Bringing you up to speed on the latest in conservation, science, and responsible hunting in Canada. Hey everyone, it's Mark Hall, and you're listening to the Round Canada Podcast. When I put all the stories together for one of these episodes, I look for a particular aspect of one of the stories that stands out, or maybe a theme that resonates through all of the stories, to come up with a title for the episode, something that's usually catchy but representative of one or all the stories that are in this particular episode. This one, there's just so much bizarre stuff going on. I didn't really have a problem coming up with the title for this episode being that you can't make this stuff up. But in reality, the irony is it's actually happening in Canada. So the lead-off story about caribou, like a lot of the stories are lately on this podcast. So the Peary caribou is a small caribou whose range is in the Northwest Territories and Nunavut's High Arctic. There's an estimated 13,200 mature Peary caribou left in the wild. According to the Federal Environment and Climate Change Canada Ministry, that's down from an estimated 22,000 in 1987. So, you know, not quite half. The herds declined by half, or the population, sorry, since 1987. So there was this story about, a Canadian Armed Forces, or the Canadian Armed Forces base in Alert, which is on the very top of Ellesmere Island. So the Federal Species at Risk Act kicked in and charges were laid against two military personnel for, I love how the language gets all smoothed out here, for alleged infractions related to caribou from the Peary herd. They also talked about the destruction and possession of Peary caribou. So some soldiers shot and killed some Peary caribou. So this incident was alleged to have occurred in September of 2021. This is important. So back in 2021, some soldiers shot some Peary caribou and took possession of them. I don't know if they're going to have a barbecue or what they were planning on doing. The Peary caribou is listed as an endangered species under Canada's Federal Species at Risk Act. They've been labeled as an endangered species since 2011. But get this, they were reassessed and downgraded to a threatened species in 2023. So let's look at the timelines here. So in 1987, there were 22,000. Now there's only 13,000. In 2021, members of the Canadian military shot and killed a caribou that was classified as an endangered species. Then last year, the classification was downgraded from endangered to just threatened. Guess what? The charges against the military personnel have been dropped. This all seems very suspicious, and it seems to me, got my tinfoil armadillo hat on here. So this seems like it's something that could blow back on the federal government, especially the Minister of Environment and Climate Change Canada. Federal soldiers killing an endangered species, they were charged, but after the incident happened in 2021, the Peary caribou, which is half of what their population was 30 years ago, miraculously got downgraded from an endangered species to simply threatened. So there was no need to charge people under the Federal Species at Risk Act for killing an endangered species. They only killed a threatened species. These two personnel, the military personnel, were still disciplined, but they went through a restorative justice process I gather from the story, there's not a lot in the story. Not a lot of information has been forthcoming from the sources, which would probably be the military and the federal government on this story. But it sounds like they went through a restorative justice process with Inuit people in the high Arctic, to basically repent for what they did, understand the caribou, and have to stand up and face Inuit people of the community. That's how a lot of the restorative justice processes in Canada work with wildlife-related crimes, I'll call it, when it involves Indigenous communities and something like the Peary caribou in the high Arctic and the Inuit people living there. This is where the accountability was. But then Crown Council, probably acting on behalf of the federal government, dropped the charges. So whether or not they just think, well, the restorative justice process was good enough, but it just, the whole thing just kind of doesn't sit right with me. Everything that's happening in the news nowadays is tending to blow up and be an issue for the federal Liberal Party, which is dropping rapidly in the polls a year out from the next federal election. So there seems to maybe have been some damage control done of a couple of Peary caribou that were shot by, Canadian soldiers. And they actually changed the classification of an endangered species within the 2 year period after this incident occurred. And it was, tied up in legal battles. Anyways, I'm just like, wow, this seems like a movie plot. Maybe there's not enough stuff blowing up and whatnot. And, ship frozen in the Arctic and that sort of stuff. But anyways, it's just like, I was quite blown away by the time chronologies of when this happened and the changing of the designation of these caribou, which, like I said, have obviously their populations are dwindling. So bizarre. Now here's the next piece that is kind of just a weird piece of this whole entire puzzle. So the endangered caribou in Quebec, the federal environmental minister, Stephen Guilbeault, had announced recently that he's threatening to invoke federal powers under the Species at Risk Act to protect Quebec's endangered woodland caribou. The big lever there of the federal government's Species at Risk Act is they can step in under the federal law into provincial jurisdiction, draw a line around the area of an endangered species and say that's critical habitat for the species, and everything that happens in that area, that designated critical habitat area, that could impact the endangered species has to go. So in something like caribou, that can be the logging industry, it could be mining and seismic exploration, oil and gas, it could be trapping, it could be hunting, it could be recreation, snowmobiling, hiking, everything. The federal government can kick all of that out in the name of protecting an endangered species. So you heard me talk about this exact story like over and over again. I think the last time was like with the spotted owl on the coast of BC. I've heard stories with the interior Fraser steelhead populations, the southern resident killer whale population, where the federal government just refuses to actually use this power to protect the species habitat or food supplies, and in the case of the killer whales off the coast of BC, which would shut down the commercial fishing industry, so on and so on. So the minister is, which I kind of find ironic, is threatening Quebec to do something about caribou when the minister's own employees basically were up in the Arctic killing endangered caribou. But that was sort of, that fire was quickly smudged out. So Quebec has apparently said that it's going to release a caribou protection strategy, which is long overdue, on the 1st of May. This is generally the game that goes on, that plan is supposed to satisfy the federal government, and then they will back off on all of this threatening, saber-rattling and posturing. But I just find these two stories back-to-back to be, I'm just going to say it, like it just seems hypocritical, you know, from the perspective of the federal government and the federal minister in its approach to protecting caribou, you know, like it's threatening the province of Quebec on one hand, which likely it won't do, but kind of, for a better sense of the word, turning a blind eye on federal employees that are killing endangered caribou in the Arctic. Anyways, totally bizarre. Switching gears a little bit to a disease of fish, the whirling disease. So British Columbia's first case of the whirling's disease was detected in Emerald Lake, which is a small alpine lake in Yoho National Park. I used to go there as a kid. It's called Emerald Lake for a reason. It's a beautiful little spot. So biologists found that the fish there were infected of the whirling disease. And apparently later on, after it was confirmed there, it was found in the Kicking Horse River, some other lakes, some other creeks that were confluences to Emerald Lake and the Kicking Horse River. So just recently, in response to this, Parks Canada, so federal, is closing all water bodies in BC's Kootenay and Yoho National Parks. It's restricting the use of watercraft in Alberta's Waterton Lakes National Park because they've known whirling disease to be in aquatic environments in Alberta for a lot longer, quite a few years now. They're planning to close the lakes and creeks and tributaries in the mountain parks of eastern BC for at least until next year in response to this. It's a parasite, the whirling disease. What's really weird about this is, to give them credit, the federal government and Parks Canada is actually doing something proactive for whirling's disease. And I mean, you can imagine, you know, like you get a parasite in water that infects fish and leads to their death and decline in populations. If you have a connected watershed, like this parasite can go anywhere. Fish move, the parasite moves, water flows. One of the dangers with whirling disease is fisher people, anglers, that are wading around fly fishing and whatnot, and boats, the parasite can attach to like your waders and your boots and be in the felt in the soles. And it can stay alive for quite some time. Now, that fisherman now moves to a different stream, wades right out into the stream, and can be the fly fisher can actually be the vector for moving the parasite from watershed to watershed or water body to water body. Now, what's not happening in this whole story is the provinces, BC and Alberta, do not seem to be restricting anything of activities that could move whirling disease, which would be boats and people fishing in the streams, at all. I have not seen any announcements yet, other than what the federal government is announcing. So it's kind of, it's strange. Like, it's like you can't make this stuff up, but it's literally like the national parks are in the headwaters of these systems. So they're going to be like, we're restricting public access to the lakes and watercraft. But meanwhile, the water with the parasite in it is flowing out of the national parks into a larger landscape, larger watersheds. But I've yet to see strategies from either of the provincial governments. If a provincial government was being more proactive than another, I would expect Alberta to be doing stuff way before BC will ever do anything. You know, part of this is also related to the risk of invasive mussels coming into BC. And the BC government was actually cutting funding to the invasive mussel decontamination and inspection stations that were along various points of the border. So it's kind of like backing off of, you know, the aquatic disease risk aspect of it in BC. So it's crazy. You know, it's sort of like whatever. It's, you know, like there's a swimming pool and there's something going in one end of the pool, and somebody's only trying to fix, you know, that pollutant or whatever, you know, that could affect people just in one part rather than, you know, addressing the whole entire swimming pool collectively. And so that's the case. The watersheds are the collective swimming pool. The Parks Canada is only trying to do what it can in its little corner of the swimming pool. Yet the rest of the owners of the remaining part of the swimming pool aren't doing anything in collaboration with what Parks Canada is doing. So just blows me away. Blows me away that these things that happen, chronic wasting disease showed up, you know, in BC this year, that these things don't really trigger like emergency type responses from our governments to enact things very rapidly, you know, like stopping the movement of watercraft, decontamination requirements for fishermen, and you know, and that's what you actually, one of the things you can do. I've been on aquatic sampling teams where prior to going into the water, they have buckets of a cleaner that kills the parasites, and you put your feet in the buckets with your waders and everything, and your boots in the lower legs, and then you go out in the stream, do your thing, and then when you move to a new location, you do that all over again. You decontaminate your waders and your boots and your equipment and everything. And very simple thing for fishermen to do if they brought in decontamination stations and some changes to fishing regulations that required you to do it and it was enforced. You know, I'm just throwing out ideas here of something that could be done, you know, immediately, but aren't. So the sad part is whirling disease is probably going to spread like wildfire through fish populations in eastern British Columbia, which is where I live, and probably have some pretty serious impacts to the fisheries and the guides and stuff that fish on the rivers. Now, switching species to bison. So Parks Canada translocated 16 Plains bison. There were 10 young females, 6 young males from Elk Island National Park, east of Edmonton. And they released them into an area of Banff National Park known as the Panther River Valley in 2017. They were in a large, high-fenced enclosure. They were there for a year and a half, and then that paddock was essentially opened up. The idea was is that they would learn that the Panther River was like their home. So when they actually kind of like opened the gates, the bison would just kind of stay there. A couple of the bulls immediately buggered off and went into like Alberta, into the province's part of Alberta, out of the national park. One of them was killed. Ranchers are all concerned, you know, with the bison and brucellosis and that sort of thing getting into the cattle. So now the herd is over 100 animals. Everybody's like, wow, the herd was growing. I think I saw like 30 or 33% per year. Very little wolf predation. I think a couple of calves were lost to wolves. The radio-collared wolves, it sounds like the wolves really don't know what to do with the bison, and the bison really don't know what to do with the wolves. They just like, neither of them are like, you know, they don't know what the heck's going on because it's new to them. And so the wolves are kind of following, a few wolves are kind of following the bison around, trying to like, you know, figure out what the heck, and they ended up getting a couple of calves. But other than that, like wolf predation has not been a really big deal. So Banff National Park is working on a broadening its bison management plan to kind of deal with the what next scenario when this population continues to grow, 100, 200, 300,000 animals moving out of the Panther River Valley. They're heading off into the provincial lands in Alberta, and what the heck are they going to do? So during a public consultation period on the 5-year bison reintroduction pilot project, the original one, approximately a third of the people that responded by that were supportive of a planned hunt to manage the bison population as it grows, to basically kind of keep their numbers commensurate with the available habitat for a particular geographic area, the Panther River area of the park, and not kind of allow them to explode. Everything I've read on this, it seems like because Parks Canada seems to be like, okay, like we're okay with the idea of a limited hunt as a management tool. Everything I've read on it sounds like that in the future, any bison hunt in and around Banff National Park will not be available to non-Indigenous hunters. It's only going to be a First Nations-based hunt to manage the herds. This does happen in and around other places in North America. There are some Indigenous harvest of bison outside Yellowstone National Park, but they also have licenses and tags and limited hunts for non-Indigenous hunters on the Yellowstone herd as well when they free range out of the national parks or when the national parks need to reduce their number. So kind of a good story and kind of a bad story. Just seen a tremendous amount of this ideology over the last few months, especially with the hunting regulations that are being proposed in BC, of this ideological shift to First Nations hunters taking priority over many areas and many types of hunting, and reducing opportunities, present opportunities and future opportunities for hunters who are not Indigenous. So I support Indigenous hunting, but I don't like to see it come at the expense of others that also want to hunt and fill their freezers with bison meat. I hope maybe in the future that if this herd expands and occupies some area on the provincial lands in Alberta, that the province in Alberta will make those hunts available to licensed residents of the province. You've heard me cover tons of stories about Canada geese and Canada's love-hate relationship with the Canada geese. They love Canada geese. They love Canadians, love all things wild, but they hate Canada geese as soon as they show up in urban areas, in green spaces, and in their parks. The small community of Vernon in British Columbia, kind of in the northern Okanagan-ish area, have been having a growing problem with Canada geese. They planned a cull a few years ago. City Council approved a cull of like 100 geese, and the dashboard lights lit up and people went nuts. And so City Council backed away from that. There were some other plans to do some captures or something and move the geese. And it's like people lost their minds over that. And so City Council shut that down. So everything to tackle a goose, which now are interestingly being labeled as an invasive species, Canada goose, as natural and as Canada as Canada gets, the Canada goose is now being labeled as an invasive species. It's crazy. Put these labels on it to justify that it's a monster that's wreaking havoc, and then eventually get the public to side with you to exterminate these things. So I hate the use of that term on any North American native species. Anyways, that's a whole different topic. We do have a podcast coming up on it, the Hunter Conservationist podcast, on 1st of April. Anyways, so the city of Vernon and their ongoing goose dilemma, listen to the city council, mayor and city council, listen to a presentation recently by an organization called the Guardians of Our Salish Estuaries. The acronym for this organization is called GOOSE. It's a First Nations-led organization that laid out a proposal for the city of Vernon to get rid of their goose problem at a cost of $107,000 over a 3-year period. First Nations would come in and people would come in, hunt the geese, and then take them away for food. However, in order to do that, it would cost the city of Vernon $107,000 over a 3-year period. I kind of quickly did the math, going back to their original approval to cull geese like a year or two ago was for 100. So over a 3-year period, if the plan would be to take out 300 geese for $107,000, it works out to like $360 a goose. Which would cost the city of Vernon $360 a goose, or maybe more if fewer geese were killed than 300 over a 3-year period. Wow. Man, I just, I don't know about you, but I think if I lived in Vernon and I was a hunter, I would be like, I'll do it for free. You know, put out some bait piles, get the geese established to coming in there, put your decoy spread out, put your lay down blinds like we do. And, you know, if I was only 15 minutes from my house or whatever, I probably think some hunters could probably take home some geese, put them in the freezer, and cook them up for their families for less than $360 a goose. Maybe it would cost you more than $360 a goose if you had to go buy all the geese decoys and lay down blinds and shotguns and stuff, but most waterfowl hunters already have that stuff, so it's like, might as well make use of it. But anyways, very interesting. The organization GOOSE would charge the city of Vernon $107,000 to deal with its problem. From what I understand, I think I did an episode last year with Dr. Lee Foote. He was saying, we were talking about the Stanley Park thing and the egg addling. He said one of the best deterrents for geese is actually going to be nest destruction. And you have to do that in full view of the parents. They have to see human beings chasing them off the nest and destroying their nests. He said that's likely in the long term going to be more effective than egg addling, which is like a non-traumatic event for a goose because they wait for the adults to leave. They go in, they addle the eggs, either oil or shake them, or they replace them with dead eggs and take the live eggs and freeze them, kill them, and then just rotate in nests. The geese come back, they sit on these nests, they think everything's good. The clutch doesn't end, like hatch, no brood, and they just go about their business. Dr. Lee Foote said, you need to like traumatize the shit out of these Canada geese so that they learn and they witness that these two-legged things don't create a safe environment to nest and they go somewhere else. I did read in this story that they said the city of Vernon was doing some egg addling thing, but the teams that were doing that were having a tough time finding where these geese were actually nesting and sort of having any amount of efficacy on destroying eggs. So they're still kind of leaning towards that they need to wham and bam slam inside a municipal park somewhere in the town of Vernon in order to actually deal with the geese. So, man, I thought my pursuits in waterfowl hunting were expensive, but $360 a goose is probably more than what I'm spending. Another bizarre story, coming from BC. Yeah, why's BC's got the fair share of the crazy stories here? Maybe not. So the BC SPCA, Society for the Protection Against Cruelty Towards Animals, applied for and was successful in obtaining two search warrants. They searched a facility in the Okanagan area and seized 85 animals, including rabbits, cats, and wildlife. The search warrants were executed on an animal rescue facility called the War and Peace Bunny Sanctuary. Sorry. Peaceful Bunny Sanctuary was abusing the shit out of animals, and the SPCA got warrants, came in, seized a whole bunch of animals. And the reason I'm covering this is because the sanctuary was housing wild animals that have been brought in. Apparently, quite a few of the seized animals were in such poor condition that they went to various veterinary facilities and were euthanized. The owners could face a $75,000 fine and or 2 years in jail and a lifetime prohibition from owning animals. I'm going to follow that story to see if that actually manifests itself, because we've had lots of discussions on this show and on the social media platforms about people's disgust at the levels of fines levied against hunters who poach. And here's a great example of a wildlife and animal infractions under different legislation. But man, $75,000 2 years and a prohibition, lifetime prohibition on owning animals. That's pretty steep. That would probably be a pretty strong deterrent for other animal rescue facilities in the province, of which there is a very famous one I've heard doesn't actually even have a permit to operate. So anyways, that's another story. Now, another bizarre story that you can't make up, I think. Luckily, it's not in BC this time. It's in Alberta. Last month, no, actually in February, There was an emergency call of an individual in Banff National Park that had been attacked and mauled by a cougar. Emergency responders arrived. The person had minor scratches and stuff, and nothing life threatening. Anyways, Parks Canada, in its ensuing investigation of the attack scene, both they would have done this both off the person's probably clothing, skin, and around the area where the attack occurred, gathered samples to do DNA testing. It's one of the things they do in predatory attack cases is they try to get DNA samples off the victim's clothing, or on the scene. So when an animal in the proximity is destroyed that they think is the offending animal, they actually do DNA to see whether or not they got the offending animal. It's done with grizzly bears, so on and so on. So rabbit hole, but there was a really famous case just north of where I live of two hunters that were killed by a grizzly bear just shortly after they took an elk. It was like literally happened while they were taking their grip and grin pictures. Really bizarre story about they were taken to the Revelstoke Hospital. Their clothes were actually incinerated and they couldn't get DNA samples off of them. Long story short, they killed three bears there and by teeth puncture marks realize that they killed the wrong bears. But it was just a bizarre story of this reminded me of the DNA thing where that's what investigators are doing. So in this case, getting back on track here, the person apparently faked this cougar attack and parks officials came out and said there is no evidence via the DNA that an attack actually took place. So why, and I've read some of the social media posts on this, why would a person fake something like that? Obviously, you get a lot of attention if you are attacked by some kind of a wild animal. And I don't know, maybe you get famous out of it and get a bunch of deals, sponsorship deals and whatever. I don't know. I don't know that what goes on with the animal attack world, but anyway, somebody faked this, and same thing, people were like going like throw his ass in jail, like it's like what the heck, right? You know, emergency responders went out, you know, parks people would have had to go out and do the full-blown site investigation and, you know, go to the hospital and get samples off the clothing and go to a DNA lab. And that stuff is like anything in a high-end scientific lab can be like tens of thousands of dollars a sample, you know, for some types of things. So yeah, I don't know whether or not the federal government's going to follow up with charges. I guess there would have to be a law that says you cannot fake being attacked by a cougar or something and then be charged under that. I don't know what the laws would be, but I was just like, wow, who would make something like that up? But anyways, they did, and you can't make that up. So now this is kind of a fishing related thing. I cover, you know, fishing related stories and some of the conflict that goes on, especially on the East Coast of Canada over various fishing rights and whatnot. So just recently, a group of commercial fishers in Newfoundland and Labrador had a huge protest gathering around the government offices in St. John's, where they were getting ready to convene sessions to do the provincial budget. And they had to bring in police on horses, and literally it was like the riot scene kind of stuff of officers on horses and you know, an angry crowd and pushing people around and whatnot. Like it was just, it was surreal. And this was all over their fishing industry. Like the fishers in Newfoundland are pissed. And they got pushed to the edge to go undertake this large protest. And like, you know, we have a right to a peaceful protest in the country. There's laws around it, but they were like, no, we're actually blocking the government buildings and we're going to make a friggin' big deal about this. So what they're mad about is who they're allowed to sell their products to, like their catch. So in Newfoundland and Labrador, the price for crab, snow crab, it's an agreed upon price. So it's set by the Fish and Allied Workers Union and the Association of Seafood Producers. So on the processing and distribution side of the seafood industry, where no different than cattle or milk or dairy or anything, the big money is not in the poor people that are farming and ranching and fishing. It's on the production end. Processing, marketing, and distribution is where all the big money is. So these, the union and the Association of Seafood Producers apparently get to fix the price for snow crab. And that is to ensure that the jobs in their unionized processing facilities stay in the province. The commercial fishermen, are upset about this, and they want to be able to get the best price that they can on in a free market for their catch. And so their beef over their fisheries catch was with the fisheries minister in Newfoundland, Elvis Lovelace. And so anyways, this went on for like part of last week, and like it was, you know, like a mini UK farmer protest kind of thing. Like, you know, they weren't spreading around, you know, dead fish and manure and stuff on the government buildings, but like it was not a peaceful protest. It was, you know, pretty mad. Yeah, people were pretty mad. So Minister Lovelace has come out and sort of said, okay, we're going to make some concessions for snow crab. And, you know, the government's going to like look into the idea of having outside buyers for the 2024 snow crab fishery. The harvesters, the fishers, commercial fishermen said that, you know, great. They kind of called it stalling. They think the minister's just stalling so that nothing happens for the 2024 fishing season. But they said, you know, this isn't just about crab. They have restrictions like this with fixed prices and who they can sell for in the province for all of their marine catches. And they want all those restrictions lifted to free up what and who they sell their fish to, because they want to get top dollar. And apparently they've been getting bottom market prices for snow crab. And so this whole thing just precipitated into, you know, a pretty serious protest in front of the government offices. And man, I just, more and more of this sort of thing is cropping up in this country and all over the world, where people have just kind of like had it. And you know, this one was particularly to do with, you know, commercial fishing and whatnot. So I covered it on this podcast. So one thing that is a concern to folks that, you know, hunt and trap and sport shoot in this country is all the stuff going on with gun control in this country. And recently, the Senator Don Platt, who is a conservative senator on Canada's Senate, which is heavily stacked to liberal senators, because they're appointed by Prime Minister Trudeau. Apparently, I think I just read a story the other day that said over 70% of the members of the Senate are Liberal government appointed senators, which is apparently not how it's supposed to work in Canada's democracy of having a Senate. So anyways, Senator Don Platt is like, he's not taking any of this gun control stuff, but he's outnumbered in the Senate when, you know, Bill C-21 went through last fall. So anyways, he recently revealed, he applied for and got the full answers from the government, that to date, the federal government has spent almost $42 million on the firearm buyback program, which is not even a program and has not even bought back any guns, so to speak. $42 million have been spent on it. There's 60 employees working on the buyback program. $2.3 million of that $42 million has been awarded to the software company, IBM, to develop a special software system for the federal government to keep track of firearms that are taken back from citizens of the province. The numbers are staggering, and we're not even at the doorstep of actually taking possessions of firearms that have been put on a prohibited list. If you remember, there's like 1,500 makes and models and all of their variants, and people are saying like they're talking like in the millions and millions of firearms, and none of that has even happened so far, and they've managed to spend $42 million of our money. Now, speaking of spending money, so the Sydney Island deer cull, which kind of like blew up just before Christmas in December. So, you know, the quick and dirty on it, there's a small island in the Gulf Island complex off the coast of British Columbia. On one end of the island, it's probably looks like it's about maybe a quarter of the landmass of Sydney Island, which is already quite small. Parks Canada has a conservancy area there where they wanted to get rid of all the deer in the national parks because they were eating the vegetation in the national park. A portion of these deer were the native coastal blacktail deer that were targeted in a cull in December, as well as the introduced fallow deer that have been on the island for, I think, like around 100 years now. So recently, a federal MP put in an inquiry to the Minister of Environment, Stephen Guilbeault, and had a series of questions. This is how it works in question period and this sort of thing in the House of Commons. Then the other minister has to, or the minister whose questions these are aimed at, has to provide a written response. So the questions were basically around like, how much did the federal government spend on this cull on Sydney Island off the coast of BC? So they spent $796,340 to kill 84 deer. Some of those were native deer to the island. So here's the breakdown. $471,662 of that was for the contractor's fees for the implementation of the operations, the aerial cull portion that was done in 2023. $79,715 was for First Nations participation. So First Nations could just be there. $49,900 was spent on the recovery of meat, dead deer, and processing them. I saw a little news story a few months ago where a lady was saying, a First Nations lady that was on the island was saying like there was nothing left of those deer because they were being gunned down with semi-automatic guns, and they're small. She just said they were hamburgered. And so there's, you know, recovery was not very good. Anyways, I don't know if that's completely true, but they spent almost $50,000 recovering the meat. The Salus Forest Strata, which is a residential association on Sydney Island, was given $24,300 to be there. They spent $43,000 on meals and meal services and equipment supplies and fuel for everybody that went there was $136,415. So works out whatever it was, $10,000 a deer or whatever. And there's more going to have to happen because, you know, they didn't get all the deer. So this is all going to have to happen again. So probably going to be in the range of $2-3 million by the time they're done. So there's where some more of your tax dollars were spent in this day and age. Can't make that up. $800,000 to kill 84 deer on a small portion of an island. They weren't even culling deer on the entire island, just the national park end of the island. And everybody that had an interest in what was going on got paid to be there. Interesting part about all of this, just to wrap it up, on April 1st of 2024, in a few days from now, the federal carbon tax will go up 23%. That's to help pay for all of this stuff, like Sydney Island deer culls, the gun buyback program that has not been bought yet. Crazy. Can't make this up. All right, everybody, you're up to date on what's going on around Canada, and we'll see you in the next episode.
Spend your Saturdays with Life on the Water. Join Captain Brandon Simmons for fishing, diving, travel, and so much more.
You want to succeed. You want to fish. You want to be one of the greatest.
Oh, look at that thing, dude.
Wow. Oh. Let's see what kind of trouble we can get into today.
Don't miss Life on the Water every Saturday night from 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern on Waypoint TV. The destination for outdoor entertainment.